Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Deborah Porterfield.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We've got a great show today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Kimberly Sanders, professor in the University of North Carolina School of Pharmacy, as well as the Department of Dental Ecology, about thinking outside the silos that separate medical disciplines. I bet this is something near and dear to you.
Absolutely. I've worked in a variety of settings, and I'm a big fan of breaking down those silos.
First, we're going to actually talk about some interesting research that matters, and let's dive right in. And it's a survey about when physicians ask patients about their health, do the patients give honest answers or do they lie, which seems like a really pejorative judging way of talking about things, but that's what the survey is about.
So in this study, they actually surveyed two different groups of average U.S. citizens. One of the groups was slightly older and one slightly younger. So they got a nice mix of types of people in the study. And not very surprising, although I guess I was a little bit surprised at how high these numbers were. So in one group, about 60% of the people surveyed. In one group, 80% of the people surveyed said that in one of, I think there were six or seven different types of not being completely forthcoming with their physician, that they admitted that the answer was yes.
So there were times where they may be asked about their diet or asked about their exercise, or at times when the doctor made a recommendation and the head was nodding, but they maybe disagreed, or maybe the doctor gave instructions and they just kind of didn't really understand but didn't say anything. All those things are a little bit different, but there is a disconnect between the provider asking or talking and what the patient's hearing or responding. So I think this is a communication problem, not necessarily a patient not telling the truth. I don't like that.
Yeah, really concerning the top two about not agreeing with a recommendation but not speaking up. And so important that we all try to break down that barrier. And then also when you don't understand the instructions, this is not a good thing. If you're leaving the doctor's office, you don't understand, but you don't feel like you can speak up and ask for better instruction.
Yeah, empowering patients to be as forthcoming. And maybe saying that right off the bat, you know, maybe we're going to talk about some things today, and some of them may be more difficult. I remember I had a patient not too long ago who has a history of substance abuse, and I hadn't seen the patient in a good while. And I said, just tell me, how's life going? How's the substance abuse going in your life? And the patient said, well, I'm going to tell you the truth, and told me about how they were doing well until birthday came. And that birthday precipitated a party, and that party precipitated a return to substance abuse. And they said afterwards, you know, I wasn't going to lie to you. And I said, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But having that trusting relationship where the patient knew they weren't going to be judged, but maybe helped to figure out the answer.
Absolutely. It's the only way we can help people. I think this study, even though it's just one study, but this is the exact kind of thing that medical students need to see so that they understand that so many times in these patient encounters, they're not getting the whole story.
Maybe asking a question than just waiting for a good while for an answer.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about our next research that matters. And it's about another problem, I think, in the healthcare environment. In this particular case, it's the cost of insulin. And, you know, we give a patient with diabetes and we say, be on 40 units of this insulin two times a day, 80 units a day, and we just assume that's what's going to happen. And this research would suggest, nope, that's not what happens a lot of the time.
A lot of the time, well, the thing about insulin and other medications, but it's really easy just to slightly scrimp on that dose. But over time, that causes a real problem. So the investigators looked at different ways of trying to stretch out your prescription, taking a smaller dose, not filling a prescription, and they found overall 1/4 of persons with diabetes said that they had skimped on their insulin because of cost.
And this turned out to be much more likely in those who actually had poor blood sugar control. 43% had done this compared to 28% who did not have poor control, which actually is not too surprising because if you've got poor control, you might actually have to use more insulin, and you might have poor control because you can't afford the medicines to start with, and then the medicines can be expensive. But it just goes to show we really better talk about that. You know, let's talk about, you know, I know I'm prescribing 40 units twice a day. How often do you not able to take that much because of the cost of the drug or because maybe it's twice a day rather than once a day or some other reason like that?
Mm-hmm. Just making sure that, that skimping isn't happening. And this goes back to the first study that we were talking about. How comfortable is a patient going to be talking to you about cost? So we have to really try hard to elicit this information.
Right, because we may think that that blood sugar control is because we're not giving enough insulin, and we might actually give a doubling of the dose of insulin or increasing that dose, when the reality is it's not the doubling of the dose that's the problem. It's the not being able to take what's already prescribed. Really important distinction, so important research. Let's talk about our next research that matters, which is about the Mediterranean diet, which we know in general has lots of positive health benefits. And how about that diet in women who are pregnant, and then what happens if they follow that diet to their children? Does there benefits? Pretty interesting question.
Yeah, great question. I'm not familiar with this study before today, and this line of research, we know a lot about the Mediterranean diet effects on weight and chronic disease. So, but what a neat population. Let's look at the Mediterranean diet in pregnant women.
Yeah, this was in the Journal of Pediatrics, and it was 2,700 pregnant women from outside the United States who filled out lots of questionnaires during pregnancy, including looking at diet and weight and being recommended this diet high in fruits, vegetables, and nuts. And they then followed the children and found that the pregnant women who were more adherent to this diet had a 32% lower risk of having children who became more overweight than the offspring of the women who didn't follow the diet, suggesting that the following this diet actually had some benefits ultimately for the children for reasons that we can hypothesize, but we don't really know.
But so suggestive of the healthy habits of the mom then influencing the child development and, you know, leads to so many other questions about, well, then what happened? So we know that there was better development during pregnancy, but what about after pregnancy?
Yeah, I think if there's any risk of obesity in the family, particularly among children, which is a large segment of the population, as one gets pregnant, having the conversation, if you hadn't had it already, about the type of diet that'd be useful and helpful, it's a good conversation to have.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the last research that matters and about a conversation that we perhaps get asked about, but maybe doctors don't know as much about, but I think patients are really interested in. And these are kind of the natural remedies for sometimes more difficult diseases that providers, regular allopathic doctors, tend to prescribe things like antibiotics. And this is one that would be, for instance, Lyme disease, and looking at kind of natural remedies for persistent symptoms. I'm sure you've had or seen or friends who have had Lyme disease and maybe have some persistent symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so such an interesting study coming from Johns Hopkins. And these investigators are doing more lab research, looking at what kinds of antibiotics or chemicals can attack or kill Lyme bacteria that are in this kind of persistent, dormant state. And there's a hypothesis that for Lyme patients who have persistent symptoms, that somehow there are Lyme bacteria that are in this persistent state. And how do we treat that?
This was published in the journal appropriately named Antibiotics, and they really looked at 10 of these essential oils, including those from garlic, myrrh trees, thyme leaves, cinnamon bark, allspice berries, and cumin seeds, seemed to show this particular activity against this persistent Lyme disease bacteria. I don't think this is ready for prime time that one then goes out if one has this persistent disease and takes a supplement of these essential oils. Any medicine, prescription or not, in too high a dose can be damaging. But it does suggest that perhaps if these are part of your normal diet and you tolerate them well, that they may offer some benefit. It certainly may not be harmful. So it's hard to know what to make of this. It but I think there's more research that's indicated.
Absolutely. And I'd love to see, you know, it looks like this lab has done quite a bit of work in this area. And some of the earlier medications they were looking at were typical kind of antibiotics. But this offers a lot of hope that some of these more natural substances, we can identify the properties that can be useful.
A clinical trial, randomized controlled trial. Maybe that's the next phase. Let's find out if it works, and let's find out if it works better than a placebo
pill. Absolutely.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to be talking with Dr. Kimberly Sanders, professor in the University of North Carolina School of Pharmacy and the Department of Dental Ecology, about thinking outside the silos that separate medical disciplines. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Deborah Porterfield. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Deborah Porterfield. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Kimberly Sanders, professor in the University of North Carolina School of Pharmacy and Department of Dental Ecology, about thinking outside the silos that separate medical disciplines. Welcome, Dr. Sanders.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. You know, I think you're approaching a topic that is really music to our ears, and I think once they hear from you, it'll be music to all of our listeners' ears, because it's an important one about working interdisciplinary across silos. How did a person trained in pharmacy get interested in working across disciplines?
Sure. So my path actually started during my residency training, when I started to think that looking for interdisciplinary collaboration would be really crucial to the future. And so as part of my residency training in Cincinnati, I had a chance to work on quite a few healthcare teams in a rounding environment and also in other environments. And from there, I kind of jumped into a fellowship position that had a chance to work with the care transitions team at UNC Family Medicine Center. And my interactions with social workers there, with the other clinical pharmacists and medical providers, I had a chance to really see us all in action, really promoting the patient's health, their future direction, all of that. And so as part of my training from there, I had the chance to start initiating a collaboration with the dental school. They were interested in interprofessional care or interdisciplinary work. And I started just with a kind of diabetes project that was actually started by dental students to screen patients that had diabetes in the dental clinics and find ways to connect them with nutrition support and also medication reviews from a pharmacy standpoint. So that was kind of the foot in the door. And then from there, it was really a chance to kind of work with not only the dental providers, but also to see what other gaps pharmacy integration could help out with as we were doing other reviews around how medications impact oral health and how chronic disease state management can really be influenced as well. So we saw that kind of bridge to dental practice, but also how that could then bridge to medical practice too.
Great.
I'm wondering, it sounds like you forged your own path. Did you have specific training? Because now interprofessional education is all the rage. Did you have specific training in this? Did you have any mentors? Or was this really you were guided by what you thought was important and where you saw a need?
I would say it was a mix of all of the above. During my fellowship training, the formal title was actually Practice Model Advancement. And so as part of my fellowship training, I did some courses with NC Tracks in study design and statistical analysis.
And that's the group that at the University of North Carolina and many other universities across the country that helped design and support practice-based research.
Yes, clinical and translational research. So a lot of health professionals who are interested in research or practice-based research may go through NC Tracks to look for additional training. So as part of my fellowship, one of my mentors and program directors, Nikki Pinelli-Ryder, actually helped me kind of look and see how I could start a research niche or a place where, you know, pharmacy wasn't necessarily explored yet. And so a lot of timing and alignment kind of worked out to where seeing this opportunity with the dental school was really a chance to explore how we already have, in many ways, established pharmacy services or clinical pharmacy services and primary care clinics or other health community environments, but never really exploring much with dentistry, really an untapped area. So seeing that and looking to kind of dive into that was really something that, for me, I like to call myself a trailblazer, and I like to call myself someone who kind of goes the unbeaten path, but really a chance to kind of explore that and see what pharmacy could do in a whole completely different environment.
You know, I think this is so exciting, and I think a trailblazer is a good, among many other terms, that I think would help describe what you're doing. And I'm thinking about, you know, doctors and dentists don't really talk very much. And I was struck recently because I have a dentist who's really interested in sleep apnea and making appliances and communicating with me about patients who really do have sleep apnea may real benefit from other ways of approaching their disease. And I thought, wow, we don't really ever reach out to many of our other colleagues. And in my training, we really never had pharmacists at the bedside and the clinic really available. You mentioned the transitions program that you worked with in family medicine. How is that an example of this interdisciplinary collaboration that listeners who maybe aren't as familiar might benefit?
So when we think about care transition, sometimes you may think specifically about the inpatient environment and going from one unit to the next. But with the care transitions clinic at the Family Medicine Center, these were really, you know, people who'd just been in the hospital for whatever reasons, long amounts of time, short amounts of time, but really, again, maybe having a lot going on. And so as the care transitions clinic served as a place to follow up with patients or people who had been recently discharged from the hospital for what we sometimes call high-risk conditions or conditions that may put patients or people at risk for being readmitted.
Like, can you think of a patient that would be a high risk of readmission, who someone who may have come out?
Sure. Congestive heart failure is a really common condition that we kind of think about or are worried about, and especially when we think of patients or people who have had conditions of fluid retention, and then that fluid retention or concern leads to difficulty breathing, difficulty moving around and walking, that can eventually sometimes lead to an emergency department visit or being admitted to the hospital.
And then you were given five different medications that are all new, and you go home and you're just supposed to navigate that. And you're smiling right now. Why does that make you smile?
Because it's so true. And if you think about the discharge process, it can be a really intensive time. People are going through, you know, making sure they can get home or to their next facility appropriately, right? Getting that whole new list of medications, not knowing what goes with what. And so as part of the follow-up visit at the Family Medicine Center and the Care Transitions Clinic, we would have our care managers, usually trained social workers, who are going over some of the access issues. Or what are some concerns with, you know, how you get around, transportation, other social determinants of health that we don't always think of from, or at least I don't always think of from a pharmacy standpoint. And then also kind of going through the steps or the processes of who do you contact now that you're out of the hospital? Where can you go so as to, you know, prevent that, making sure they have that contact list. And then from the pharmacy perspective, we would go step by step through all of the medications, new and old, and making sure that everything's clear, everything that they're taking makes sense, and that the schedule also makes sense. There also might be changes that we make at that appointment, too, to make it easier for our people to stay out of the hospital.
And I want it. Sign me up. I don't want to go to the hospital, but if I did, this is something I would want.
Yeah. So there's a doctor, there's a pharmacist, there's a social worker. Anyone else in this clinic?
I'm usually nursing, too.
Nursing.
So, yes, definitely key. All of those individuals playing a role in the care plan or the team approach to what we would do next.
You know, this idea of this interdisciplinary collaboration in the dental ecology, the dentist program, how is this translated actually into better health outcomes? What have you found?
So most commonly, we've identified a lot of medication-related issues while we're in the clinics with the dental students and dental providers. And these common kind of conditions that basically can help inform how we then train our future dentists, so these dental students, and preparing them to go out into practice. But then I also work in continuing education for other dental providers as well. And so things that I've been able to identify in our practice clinics have translated to things that I then see that other dental providers on the community may face. And so health outcomes relates to, one, making it easier for patients to understand what they're taking, how they're taking, and two, connecting them back to primary care or connecting them back to other resources to help address the problems that we do identify. I think all of those lead to better health outcomes in general.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, let's continue having this conversation about health outcomes, some of the research that you're doing that's bridging new fields, really important health issues. We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Saunders, professor in the University of North Carolina School of Pharmacy and the Department of Dental Ecology, about thinking outside the silos that separate medical disciplines. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Deborah Porterfield. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with Dr. Kimberly Saunders, professor in both UNC's School of Pharmacy and Department of Dental Ecology, about thinking outside the silos that separate medical disciplines. We've heard a bit so far about some of your project work and the ways that you're working with primary care and dentists and a variety of other professions to improve the care for patients. I'd love to ask the question about how you are involved in teaching. So clearly, you're forging new paths. You're part of some very exciting programs which are bringing professionals together to care for patients in new ways. How do you turn around and teach the next generation of providers?
Thank you for your question, Deborah. So one of the ways that I've currently been involved in teaching is through a interprofessional education geriatrics program that we offer. So I help coordinate the geriatrics elective within our pharmacy school. But in the years past, we actually formed a huge collaboration of all 10 health disciplines coming together on 2 days in January and February as a case-based discussion among 10 health disciplines students. And so we have representation from all the major health discipline schools. I would name them all, but I think I might miss one. But just know that we do cover nursing, speech, pathology, PT, OT, all of the major health disciplines. And students from each of these schools or programs come together, and they meet during a time of about a 3-hour block twice. And within these case discussions, we've organized it in a way for each discipline to kind of hold on to a certain piece of information that other health disciplines may not know or may not be aware of in their scopes of practice of what this health discipline can do. And so it's really awesome to see all of the students come together, talk through a specific patient case. For example, this year we're planning one, and hopefully none of the students are listening, but we're planning one that is around opioid prescribing and how that can be impacted or how that can impact the health of our older adult population. And they have to navigate what would be the best care plan for this patient, incorporating all the social determinants of health, access issues, and other medical conditions that the patient has as well.
So if we were to think about the traditional way of looking at opioid prescribing, patient comes in to the provider, they've got some chronic pain, the provider writes an opioid prescription, and it goes to the pharmacist. Patient comes back in 3 months and gets new prescriptions. Mm-hmm. How does your model change? Why is it needed? Help us understand how this different perspective improves the healthcare outcomes of these patients with opioid, which is one of the greatest problems facing society today.
Right. So obviously, chronic pain it's a big issue to tackle. And sometimes we don't always know what the best direction is. It's an individualized approach for our patients and for those who are seeking pain relief. And so in coming from an interdisciplinary perspective, sometimes it may not just be a medication that someone can take. Sometimes physical therapy or occupational therapy or the other health disciplines, navigating what are some non-pharmacological or non-medicine approaches that can really help in alleviating pain.
Because you're in pain, you don't move so well, you don't move as much, you get stiff.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly, Adam. So a lot of those factors, sometimes if we just, go to the script or go to writing for a medication, maybe we're missing something, or maybe we're not taking into account all the issues that a patient may be encountering as part of their care. So this interdisciplinary approach from multiple perspectives can really help in identifying maybe what the other root causes of the pain are that maybe we're not addressing.
And as a pharmacist in training, what would be the sorts of things that you think that particular training brings to this interdisciplinary discussion? Because again, you could go to a community pharmacist when you get the prescription, but you have a different plan that's probably more about getting that foot in the door and how that then expands.
Right. So a lot of the things that we will talk about are, what is the cause of the pain? So is the source of the pain something that can be alleviated by the medications we're talking about? So one of my common examples I actually talk about in the dental practice field is that if you're getting a tooth pulled or an extraction or a root canal, something that will cause pain, that can actually trigger like an inflammatory response. And so if we think about the medications or the treatment that would actually alleviate inflammation, that isn't usually an opioid, or it isn't usually a narcotic preparation. So there are other alternatives like using ibuprofen or naproxen that can actually help in reducing that inflammation process that might be safer for our patients to take in general versus a narcotic preparation that has all of the side effects and issues. So we take the approach of, recognizing what kind of side effects the medications that we'll be adding on to already a patient's list, and bringing that approach to, are we actually addressing the cause of the pain?
Just the thought of a root canal makes me cringe just a little bit.
Don't do them myself, so I too cringe a little bit when I think of them.
Well, and that's not what I was thinking of while you were talking. I was thinking of how lucky are the patients that can come to a place like UNC where they can seek care from an interdisciplinary team. How many years will it take until these kind of interdisciplinary groups are more common practice, and what would that look like?
You bring up a really good point, Deborah, and I think a lot of the barriers, I think there are obviously people who are interested in this work and wanting to do this work and contribute in a team collaboration standpoint, but I think some of the barriers are still very systemic. So if we think about how billing processes are for reimbursement or for services or recognizing the roles of the other healthcare professionals on the team, that is something that we will have to continue to work towards and move towards, whether insurance or payers recognize the benefits of the other healthcare team members, which we're moving in that process and making progress. But again, these are other areas that, as we want to be more team collaborative, value-based care, these are things we'll have to continue to address.
You talked about having kind of a foot in the door, and I love that metaphor because it's the opportunity. There's a threat there too. It could be, it's kind of scary to be there. What's the next or several other things that you think, you need to have your foot in the door? There's a real need out there that's not being met. Do you have some things that, your wish list kind of that you're dreaming about?
Well, one of the biggest barriers that we face in me being a pharmacist practicing in the dental practice space is the electronic health record access. So we operate on a very different electronic health record than many larger medical institutions. And so being able to better share this information can help in the continuity of care for our patients. So as a foot in the door approach, one of the opportunities is that by being in the dental practice environment and exploring chronic disease state management issues, as people come in with diabetes and hypertension, high blood pressure, and asthma, COPD, these are very common conditions across the board from medical to dental, but they overlap in many ways. And if by having a foot in the door to say, you know, this medication that you're taking, let's, for example, say Symbicort, it has an inhaled corticosteroid. A lot of the times when I meet with patients in the dental practice clinics, I'm talking about counseling around, you know, rinsing your mouth after you use an inhaled corticosteroid preparation.
To avoid getting infection with yeast or something like that.
Exactly. To avoid a fungal infection that can really impact your oral health or your oral care or the ability to do procedures afterwards. And so triggering that and then checking in on adherence to inhalers can really help in identifying other things. And then my hope is that by having a foot in the door, that then we can tie back to who is your primary care provider? Who else are you seeing regarding this condition? Would you mind if we reached out to them to let them know that we've touched base with you on these issues you identified? So that closed loop communication is really a huge project, but I'm hoping to move forward in that as well.
Some really exciting ideas we're hearing here. Well, unfortunately, we're at the end of our time, but before we conclude, any final thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I think as a final thought, I just like to encourage listeners to be advocates for their health and be informed and maybe look at your pharmacist a little bit different when you go into the community pharmacy or in the clinic and know that we're looking to explore other ways to advance not only our health profession, but also help other health professions advance in making sure that we can give the best holistic care that we can.
Yeah, I think that's such a powerful message. We want to thank you, our guest today, Dr. Kimberly Sanders, for really helping us open some doors and being the trailblazer that you are for your health listeners. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to be talking about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Deborah Porterfield. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to talk about listeners' health questions and concerns. And Deb, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today. Laura?
I have headaches that I get about once a month, and they're usually pretty mild and respond well to Tylenol. Over the last month, however, I've been getting them almost daily. When should I start to worry about getting an MRI or a CAT scan?
You know, this is the type of question that actually I bet almost every patient who's had a headache thinks about it at some point in time, and probably every provider who sees a patient with a headache thinks about it at some point in time. But yet, it's probably something that people don't talk about very much.
I agree. And headaches are so common and something that can be very scary, especially if they're starting to happen more frequently or be more severe.
You know, I remember early on in my training, Deb, when I was taught, like, oh, you have to worry about brain tumors and you have to worry about bleeding in the brain and all these things. And, you know, we were almost taught to think about getting CAT scans and MRIs pretty frequently. And then all of a sudden, I go into my training and they're like, well, no, most people do not need CAT scans and MRIs. And it kind of went a little bit in the other direction that like we almost never got them. And somehow with more time in practice, I seem to develop this kind of this middle of the road where I kind of begin to know, I think, when I need to think about those things.
Fortunately, most headaches and most patients do not need a workup, but all patients who are scared about their headaches need to talk to their doctor. So that's the first thing that I would say is it sounds like that these headaches are concerning to you, so certainly bring them into your doctor to have this discussion. And also, fortunately, headaches tend to fall into certain kind of patterns. And so physicians in primary care can recognize these patterns and for the most part, reassure you that you likely don't need any kind of a CAT scan or MRI. But when you go in to see your doctor, certain kinds of symptoms and certain aspects of the physical exam that they'll do could suggest that maybe you're one of the patients that it would be a good idea to have a CAT scan or an MRI.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think if it falls really outside of that kind of pattern, and they talk about, you know, what that's called a thunderclap headache that just comes on really hard. It reaches this intensity in the, you know, really, really quickly versus, you know, most headaches, you get a headache, it starts getting a little worse. It starts getting a little worse over time. But this headache comes on really quickly, and that's never been your pattern before. Okay, that could be a really worrisome feature, a headache where all of a sudden you lose sensation on the side of your face, or you have some sort of numbness in another part of your body, a headache that your vision gets totally double vision or something like that. These are the sorts of things that are unusual. It falls outside that pattern. Mm-hmm. Those things you do need to see your doctor, and it may make your doctor start to think, do I need to do this CAT scan or MRI? Because let's face it, anything that's worrisome, you're worried about a stroke, we're worried about a stroke, cancer, let's just put it out there and say either it's not or we could find out if it's not.
Another thing to talk about is just migraines. Migraines themselves have patterns, but also migraines are headaches that have some scary symptoms. And so, again, very important that you go in and talk to your doctor, express your concern, and have them have a good look at you.
Great advice. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I've had some back pain for a while, and my physician suggested an x-ray for my back. When he sent the report back to me, it said that I had degenerative arthritis of the lumbar spine. That sounds like a terrifying diagnosis and also a little bit of a value judgment. My physician said to call if I have any questions, and I do have some comments and questions.
Believe me, I've made that mistake several times in my career. You know, I get the x-ray report from the radiologist and I'm, you know, kind of tired, real busy, and I can just send the x-ray report versus typing back in an interpretation of the x-ray report. And let me tell you, x-ray reports are kind of scary, and sometimes I could, even as a patient, if I've had x-rays, I can feel like they're a little condescending using words like degenerative, like degenerate. You know, I can understand those words kind of have common roots and maybe make you don't feel very smart.
Yeah, that's a medical term. So it sounds like what we could do is explain what does that mean, degenerative joint disease.
Sometimes we say on x-rays that a patient has cervical radiculitis, which is kind of a ridiculous way of saying you got arthritis in your neck. You know, and we use these fancy terms, spondoarthropathy, you know, spondylolisthesis, cervical stenosis, lumbar stenosis, all these terms that mean you got arthritis or something very similar to it in a different part of your body. And most people know what arthritis is, but even then, you probably have questions. Mm-hmm. Is this really bad? Is it going to get worse? Am I going to be incapacitated? Am I not going to be able to work? Those are just common questions.
So as you said, Adam, this is arthritis. And we're sorry to hear that you have back pain. And without knowing too much more, whether this is a lot or a little, but it sounds like it was enough for you to get the x-ray. Well, the good news is it's arthritis. And degenerative doesn't sound good, but this is a very common condition. There's so many things that can help with back pain. And it's good news that it is just this degenerative diagnosis, which again, it's not anything else.
Yeah. And I would encourage you, give a little feedback to your provider. I would want that feedback because again, I've made this mistake sometimes in the past. So, you know, feedback is good and hopefully your provider says, thank you. I'll try to do a little bit better next time. Laura, what's our very last house call?
My wife is 30 years younger than I am. This didn't seem like a big problem when we got married 30 years ago, but it increasingly has become a problem now that I've gotten much older and she wants to travel and do things. I'm in my 80s now and I can't really travel. You did a show recently about divorce, and while I don't think I want to be alone, perhaps it's not fair to either of us to stay together.
There's some complexity in this question, and I appreciate the question. It's a real issue in this relationship, and I think it's an honest question about what's best for both of you. And obviously, I think a marriage therapist would be very important here. What do you think, Deb?
Definitely agree. And of course, starting the conversation, bringing this up can be, I'm sure, a very difficult moment for you and your wife. And maybe you can navigate some of these conversations, just the two of you, but a professional to help steer you in the direction so that you both are able to share really how you feel about this.
And there's all kinds of issues that are going to come up relating to activity level, relating to sexuality, relating to work, relating to travel, relating to things that maybe you have different wants and desires, and maybe that's changed, and how you can either stay in the relationship with some change and support and freedom to be able to do the things that both of you want to do, perhaps, but still could be together versus needing to get divorced. I think we couldn't predict that. It does sound like, though, that both of you maybe recognize that some help would be indicated. Well, that'll conclude our house call today. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues throughout the show that are important to you and your health. And you can share any question by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank Dr. Deborah Porterfield, our great guest co-host today, and Dr. Kimberly Sanders, our guest today. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.